attacked a church and synagogue in Russia's North Caucasus region of Dagestan. An Israeli attack in Gaza hits a UN aid station.
There were piles of dead bodies, blood everywhere. Frankly, it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
And the World Worm Charming Championship was held in the UK on Sunday.
195 worms!
Today is Monday, June 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. Thick smoke rose from a synagogue and an Orthodox church, both of which were on fire, following a series of attacks in the southern Russian region of Dagestan on Sunday. At least 15 police officers were killed and several others injured when gunmen opened fire, according to Russian news agencies. They're quoting Dagestan's governor. Incidents like this have become more common in the Russian Caucasus. It is unclear if the attackers were part of a group like the Islamic State, which claimed responsibility for an attack in Moscow in March. Russia blamed the United States after a Ukrainian attack on the Russian-annexed Crimea Peninsula using U.S.-supplied missiles, which killed at least 5 people, including 3 children, and injuring 124 others. A spokeswoman for the Russian Foreign Ministry, Maria Zakharova, said on Sunday that Russia would seek a response from the international community. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday that the phase of intense fighting against Hamas was coming to an end, but that the war would not end until the Islamist group no longer controls the Gaza Strip. He also doubled down on his claim that the U.S. is withholding weapons, although the White House says that is not true. As we hear now in this report from VOA's Arash Arabasadi, Israeli attacks over the weekend in Gaza killed people at UN aid sites, according to the aid agencies.
Sunday in Gaza City, witnesses say at least 8 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike outside an aid center run by the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. It was just one such mass fatality event in recent days near a humanitarian aid facility in the besieged Palestinian territories. At least 25 people were reported killed in a bombing near a Red Cross field hospital in Rafah. Head of the International Committee of the Red Cross Rafah office, William Schomburg, on an agency feed as provided by the Associated Press.
The scale of this shock was quite unprecedented, at least for us. And to give you one very unfortunate but graphic detail, we literally found body parts scattered in different areas, including within the compound, which we then later collected.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week released a video publicly accusing the White House of withholding weapons and ammunition from Israel. At a cabinet meeting over the weekend, he told officials that the basic state of affairs did not change with the U.S., adding that weapons shipments have slowed to a trickle. The White House says Netanyahu's comments came as a shock. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby at a White House briefing as provided by AP.
Those comments were deeply disappointing and certainly vexing to us, given the amount of support that we have and will continue to provide Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Following a week in which Netanyahu disbanded his war cabinet, Israelis again turned out for their weekly protest of Netanyahu's government, calling for his removal and the return of hostages still held by Hamas. Meanwhile, Israel continues operations in bordering Lebanon, targeting a member of the Hamas-allied Islamic group. Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the IDF is ready for any further action in Gaza, Lebanon, and unspecified additional places. Gallant left Sunday for meetings in Washington. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
So let's dig into this. Joining us now to talk about it is Professor James Gelvin at the University of California, Los Angeles. So I just wanted to take a moment and focus on Prime Minister Netanyahu in all of this. You know, new attacks, in Gaza. Apparently, they hit near or on a aid station for the United Nations. They're building up their forces in the north. He says the United States is withholding weapons. The United States, the White House, says they are not. And the other is that, you know, there is talk that Israel does not want to relinquish control of Gaza.
Right.
And they don't ever want the Gaza to be part of a Palestinian state. Let's start with what Netanyahu is saying about weapons, and the White House is refuting that. Is he? I don't doubt the White House in this. Is he posturing?
Oh, Netanyahu is totally playing to a domestic audience. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he's fundamentally in a bind here. On the one hand, he has to keep the extreme right wing in his cabinet in order to maintain the government. If the government falls, he goes to jail. And he knows that full well, and he doesn't want the government to fall. So he has to, you know, appease those people who are in the extreme right. At the same time, what he has to do is to appease those people who are saying that the war is being done in a way that is not going to win it. And that includes, for example, the generals who have said that there is no way possible that Netanyahu's war plan is feasible, is workable at all, and that Netanyahu is going to bring about the destruction of Hamas. So what he has to do is figure out a way of tempering both of these sides, and this is the way he goes about doing it.
You know, in that regard, I saw a report, because he said Sunday that he said to his cabinet that they're very close to ending the aggressive war action in Gaza. And yet Hamas says they were attacking this weekend Israeli forces with heavy weapons. To your point that the general's saying that you cannot, you know, kill Hamas this way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you start dealing with, okay, how many people have we killed? What's the body count? Then you know that you're on a losing strategy. And that's exactly where the Israelis are. And the generals know that. This was the American strategy in Vietnam, and it didn't work then. And fundamentally, Hamas is totally integrated into the Gazan population. It's the largest employer in Gaza. It controls healthcare, it controls social services, it controls police, it controls all aspects of governance. And it controls a lot of patronage in Gaza as well. So fundamentally, you're not going to uproot Gaza. You're not going to destroy Gaza. Hamas. The best thing you could hope for is to, I think what the Israeli strategy is to declare victory and withdraw at a certain point when Hamas has been degraded. And then go back to the previous strategy of going in and what they call mowing the grass. The idea that the Israelis will go in every year or so, destroy Hamas's weapons capabilities, then withdraw again. Hamas will acquire new weapons capabilities, and then the Israelis will go in and destroy that again. And that'll be a perpetual thing. And I think that that's what the Israelis are shooting for. In the meantime, however, what's really important for Netanyahu is that he continues the war. He continues the idea that they're going to end up the war with the destruction of Hamas, and then he keeps his coalition together, and that's what he's attempting to do. And one of the aspects of that is what he's attempting to do when he claims that the Biden administration is not giving him weapons. He wants to demonstrate the fact that the Israeli administration is, you know, as muscular as it can possibly be. And if that means taking on Israel's long-term ally, the United States, that means taking on the United States.
So you think that's why it looks like they're about to start a conflict in the north to keep the war going?
There's always been this idea that whether or not to attack the north. And it was proposed very early on in the war that, you know, basically what you want to do is clear out Hezbollah from the southern part of Lebanon. The problem is that the Israelis at this point probably don't have the capability of doing two fronts on the same war. They can't, you know, be in Gaza and they can't be in the north at the same time. So what's going on now is that Netanyahu and the cabinet is clearing out the south, you know, partially, and redeploying troops into the north to take on Hezbollah. And this also serves part and parcel of the Israeli narrative, which is that the war is not against the Hezbollah, and the war is not against Hamas. The war is against Iran. And Iran is participating in two fronts here. And so what the Israelis also have to do is participate in two fronts.
And what about this talk of never allowing Gaza to become part of a Palestinian state?
That's not new at all. Netanyahu recently claimed that he's tried to prevent a Palestinian state for 20 years and he'll continue to try to prevent it, you know, into the future. At the present time, there's very little constituency for a Palestinian state in Israel, so it's a good political move on his part. The problem is that the only way out of this entire embroglio is to is a political solution. It's not going to be a military solution. And if you don't go with the idea of a Palestinian state, you're not going to reach that political understanding. So the commitment to prevent a Palestinian state, either in Gaza or in Gaza and the West Bank, is something that the Israelis are committed to. So what would be the final solution then for this whole problem? Well, a real solution would be a political solution in which you would have, for example, elements of the Palestinian Authority establish themselves in Gaza. What it looks like is going to happen is that the Israelis are going to complete their destruction of Gaza, continue to have a presence there whenever they need to have a presence there, but in the meantime, hand it over to various clans and merchant families and people like that who are not affiliated with Hamas. In other words, to encourage warlords to establish themselves in Gaza. And of course, we've seen how that worked in the 1980s in the lead up to the Lebanon War. It doesn't work very well at all. Very few people want to sign up to become a Quisling among the Palestinian population to begin with. And secondly, the life expectancy of people who do is very, very short. So it's probably an effort that's going to lead to failure.
Hmm. Thanks so much for the time.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Professor James Galvin at the University of California, Los Angeles. We're following these other stories from around the world. Six climate protesters stormed the 18th Green while the leaders were lining up their pots for the final hole of regulation at the PGA Tour's Travelers Championship on Sunday, spraying smoke and powder. They were wearing T-shirts with the words, "No golf on a dead planet." Brazilian women marched on the main drag along Copacabana Beach on Sunday, protesting a bill in Brazil's conservative Congress that would equate abortions after 22 weeks to homicide and establish sentences of 6 to 20 years in prison. North Macedonia's lawmakers on Sunday approved a new nationalist-dominated government of Prime Minister Histrion Mikowski, whose party won general elections in May, banking on voters' angers at the slow pace of European Union integration. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 presidential election, the first of two U.S. presidential debates will take place Thursday. But the candidates' rhetoric around sensitive topics like immigration and former President Donald Trump's recent hush money trial conviction is already heating up. Here's VOA's Veronica Valderas Iglesias with the details.
Americans must wait until Thursday to know if Donald Trump's criminal conviction will be used as a line of attack on the debate stage by his Democratic re-election challenger, President Joe Biden. Mitch Landrieu, national co-chair of Biden's re-election campaign, commented on the matter when he appeared Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press.
But it's not just to call Donald Trump a convicted felon. It goes to his behavior and it goes to his character. Remember, he's actually filed bankruptcy six times. That means that he's not just a bad business guy. It means he screwed all the small people who actually relied on him for a living.
Trump denies those accusations and has also vowed to appeal the guilty verdict. While Biden has been preparing for the upcoming presidential debate behind closed doors, Trump opted to hit the campaign trail over the weekend. he made appearances in Washington and Philadelphia. He didn't hide his eagerness to debate, and at times asked his supporters' opinions on how he should behave when confronting Biden.
Should I be tough and nasty and just say you're the worst president in history, or should I be nice and calm and let him speak? 50-50. Be tough.
The presumptive Republican presidential nominee also used Saturday's rally to remind voters about his stance on undocumented immigrants.
And on day one, we will begin the largest domestic deportation operation in American history. We have no choice.
Biden recently rolled out asylum processing restrictions at the southern border. But he also unveiled an action last week that would open the path to citizenship to undocumented spouses of U.S. citizens. During his appearance on NBC, Biden's national re-election campaign co-chair blamed Trump and Republicans for the status quo.
The border is in trouble, and it has been for the past 20 or 30 years in this country. Joe Biden, on day one, sent a comprehensive immigration reform proposal to Congress. They did nothing with it.
Besides immigration, it is expected that Biden and Trump will be asked questions about several other thorny issues during the first presidential debate that will be hosted by CNN on June 27th. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
In Kenya, protesters marched and chanted outside a school where President William Ruto and other officials were attending the consecration of a bishop. During the ceremony, Ruto referred to the protesters.
I am very proud of our young people. They have stepped forward tribeless. They have stepped forward peaceful. And I want to tell them, we are going to engage them. We are going to have a conversation so that together we can build a greater nation.
Protests against Ruto's finance bill have been ongoing since details of the legislation were announced. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. More than 1,300 people died during this year's Hajj in Saudi Arabia as the faithful faced soaring temperatures. Nearly 2 million Muslims will reach the end of Hajj this week, but the extreme heat is something that will have to be dealt with for decades more. Reuters correspondent Sakir Jasny takes a look at this for us.
Nearly 2 million Muslims will complete the Hajj this week. The Hajj's timing is based on the lunar year, moving back 10 days each year. While the Hajj is now moving towards winter, it will occur in the peak of the summer in Saudi Arabia by the 2040s. Climate scientist Fahad Said says these deaths hint at future risk for millions of Hajj pilgrims.
We need to prepare, we need to adapt, we need to introduce the adaptation option as much as we can, while realizing that it will compromise on the centuries-old ritual, but still we need to save people. But at the same time, we must do climate action to stop the global warming at 1.5 degrees centigrade. At anything beyond that, I mean, we are putting those pilgrims at the risk of death.
Heat-related deaths during the Hajj have been recorded since the 1400s. Pilgrims' vulnerability stems from exertion, exposure, and older age, as well as a simple lack of acclimatization to the heat. According to Saudi officials last year, more than 2,000 people suffered from heat stress during that Hajj. A 2021 study in the journal Environmental Research Letters found that if global temperatures rise by 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, heat stroke risk for Hajj pilgrims will increase by 5 times. Still, pilgrims remain determined. For some, it's a once-in-a-lifetime affair.
Hajj is the fifth pillar of Islam, and it is a mandatory duty for every capable person, so you have to exert efforts and get tired. Hajj is a difficult task, so you have to exert efforts and perform the rituals even in the conditions of heat and crowding. You use an umbrella, drink water, and pour it onto your body to prevent dehydration, and the water sprinklers in the walkways help.
In 2016, Saudi Arabia implemented a heat strategy with shaded areas, water points at every 500 meters, and improved healthcare. Saudi health authorities advise pilgrims to stay hydrated and avoid outdoor activities from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. during this year's Hajj.
Reuters correspondent Sakir Jasny. NVIDIA has signed a deal to deploy its artificial intelligence technology at data centers owned by Qatari Telecom Group, or Ooredoo, in five Middle Eastern countries.
Ooredoo is very proud to sign that agreement with NVIDIA, putting Ooredoo at the forefront in the region for AI. And this falls right in our strategy of becoming the leader in the region for digital infrastructure.
Ooredoo's CEO, Aziz Aruthman Fakhroo, says the move will make it the first company in the region to be able to give clients of its data centers in Qatar, Algeria, Tunisia, Oman, Kuwait, and the Maldives direct access to NVIDIA's AI and graphics processing technology. And finally, the World Worm Charming Championship was held in the UK's Cheshire on Sunday. The objective? Get as many worms as you can.
Various techniques that you can try. It's supposed to be the way that you hit the fork and mimic the rain that attracts them to the surface.
Of course, that method is just too conformist for some.
We'd try doing it by dressing up and singing as well. And we still haven't caught any worms.
And the winner is
195 worms!
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. Get our apps from Google and Apple, and you can see us online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Wolterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A second cargo ship has reportedly sunk in the Red Sea after being attacked by Houthis. On June 12th, the Greek-owned MV Tudor was targeted by a bomb-carrying drone boat and other projectiles. A crew member of the Tudor was killed, bringing to four the number of sailors who have died in such attacks. On June 13th, the Houthis attacked the Ukrainian-owned MV Verbena, severely wounding a mariner who had to be medically evacuated. The U.S. Defense Department reports that since November 19th, there have been 190 attacks on commercial vehicles by the Houthis. Most have been thwarted by U.S. and international forces, but tragically not all. The Yemen-based, Iran-backed Houthis have escalated their drone and missile strikes on commercial shipping following Hamas's terror attack on Israel on October 7th and Israel's subsequent military operation to root out Hamas in Gaza. With their assaults on commercial shipping, the Houthis claim to be acting on behalf of Palestinians, yet, as National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby noted, they are targeting and threatening the lives of third country nationals who have nothing to do with that conflict.
The Houthis killed an innocent crew member from the Philippines and critically wounded a Sri Lankan sailor who were guilty of no crimes, who were simply doing their jobs as professional mariners. They weren't delivering arms to Israel. They weren't taking sides in the Middle East. They were just manning their posts aboard ship, trying to earn a paycheck and keep global commerce moving. This is pure terrorism. There's simply no other word for it.
Even the Yemeni people have been victimized, said communications advisor Kirby, as the Houthis struck a ship that was bringing grain to their own ports.
These attacks also obstruct humanitarian aid to Sudan, where the needs are tremendous and the conditions desperate, and they impact commerce for every neighboring country in the Horn of Africa and the Middle East.
As part of a U.S. government-wide effort to thwart attacks by the Houthis, the Treasury Department announced new sanctions designations against individuals and entities that are involved in the Houthi weapons procurement network. These Houthi attacks are truly reckless, said communications advisor Kirby. They don't care a whit about Palestinians in Gaza. It's terrorism, as I said, pure and simple, and it has to stop.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.